We'll hear arguments first this morning in Maher against Virginia Gagne and others. Shouldn't that be "and others," not et cetera? Mr. Walsh, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This is a case which is here on certiorari from the Second Circuit. It is a case in which the district court made an award of attorney's fees against the petitioner, the Connecticut Commissioner of Income Maintenance, in his official capacity, to be paid out of state funds of the state of Connecticut to the respondent's attorneys in the amount of some $3,000. The district court found the award to be authorized by the Civil Rights Attorneys Fees Awards Act of 1976 to the plaintiff as the prevailing party. The case was settled by consent decree.
Mr. Walsh, yes, looking at page 21A of the petition for certiorari, did the consent decree reserve to the court the right to fix attorney's fees for the plaintiffs in the case?
It did not, Your Honor, but in all candor, it must be said that prior to the entry of the consent decree, the state proposed that each party would pay its own costs, and the respondent's attorneys refused to agree to that, and we decided we would leave it to the district court when they brought a motion subsequently for attorney's fees.
So the state, in effect, consented that after the consent decree was entered, a motion for attorney's fees or a new suit for attorney's fees could be brought?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the only way that we could get the consent decree signed. We did not agree that attorney's fees were awarded. Permissible awarded. We did not agree to awarding attorney's fees.
But you also say that, at least orally, you did not agree that the consent decree settled all the issues in the case, including the issues of whether attorney's fees should be awarded.
That's correct, Your Honor. We apprised the district court judge of our agreement that we had not remained silent. It was not to be inferred that the agreement was conclusive. In other words, they reserved the right to bring the motion before the court, if I'm answering your question correctly. This case presents two issues to this court. First, the first issue is whether the award is in fact authorized by the the Fees Awards Act, or conversely, whether or not the 11th Amendment prohibits such an award. And secondly, even if the award is not authorized by the Fees Act, whether or not, as the Second Circuit has held, the award has but the ancillary effect of an award for prospective injunctive relief under Edelman versus Jordan and would not be barred by the 11th Amendment. The case began when the respondent, who was a recipient under Connecticut's Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, challenged the state's practices and policies with respect to awarding her employment expenses. She was employed at full time, and under the federal statute, Section 402A7 of the Social Security Act, that section requires that any expenses reasonably attributable to the earning of income must be deducted from a person's gross earnings in computing the amount of their welfare assistance award. The respondent claimed specifically that the department's imposed a maximum allowance with respect to transportation allowance for her private automobile of 6 cents a mile, and a maximum lunch allowance, 50 cents for lunch. She also claimed that they did not allow her certain work-related clothing expenses, which she had. Before bringing the action, the respondent requested and received an administrative fair hearing on these issues of the expenses, and the state was upheld on the transportation and lunch expenses. It was directed to award her any fees she had for work-related clothing, which she could prove. And a fourth issue that she brought at the administrative hearing was abandoned when she brought this case. She also claimed she was entitled to deduct her 16-year-old son's working expenses from her award. After 5 months after bringing the suit, the state amended its policy, which is contained at A66 of the appendix, so as to provide expressly that any expenses reasonably attributable to employment were to be allowed to AFDC recipients. And the amended policy is at A68 and 69 of the appendix. Subsequently, about a year in September 1976, the plaintiff filed an amended complaint claiming that the new policy as revised still routinely disallowed expenses of the plaintiff. Finally, after some discovery, a consent decree was entered into, and the district court, I think, awaited this court's decision in Huddle versus Finney and subsequently entered its award of attorney's fees in favor of plaintiff's attorneys of approximately $3,000 as the prevailing party under the Fees Act. The case was appealed to the Second Circuit. Second Circuit affirmed the district court's award, holding that the Attorney's Fees Award Act authorized a fee payable against the state in a case where the a constitutional claim was combined with a statutory claim under 1983, and the case was settled without a final determination on the merits of the constitutional claim, so long as there was a common nucleus of operative fact between the statutory and the constitutional claim. The state claims that the Court of Appeals test adopted, which was adopted from the legislative history of the House report, does not meet the requirements of this court in the case of Fitzpatrick versus Bitzer, which held that in order to abrogate a state's 11th Amendment immunity, Congress must be acting pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to enforce a substantive guarantee of that amendment. It has become clear since this court decided Chapman versus Houston Welfare Rights Organization last June, I believe it was, that the respondent, in our view, did not even assert, much less prevail, upon a claim seeking to enforce a substantive guarantee of the 14th Amendment. We arrived at that conclusion by the fact that in Chapman, this court said that standing alone, Section 1983 confers no substantive rights on a plaintiff's claim, and that you must look to the underlying statutory claim then to determine what is the substantive basis of the plaintiff's claim. And in this case, the substantive basis of the plaintiff's claim is a claim to enforce a provision of the Social Security Act. What had been somewhat unclear before Chapman was the fact that customarily these claims for welfare claims, as we call them, were asserted in the format of a constitutional claim of violations of the 14th Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses of the 14th Amendment. Under the doctrine of Higgins versus Levine, that would confer jurisdiction on the federal court to hear the case, and unless the claim was wholly insubstantial or frivolous, and the court would then proceed to dispose of the statutory claim. In most cases, the constitutional claim was never decided. And so we claim...
Well, what about in a case like that where there is unquestionably a constitutional claim joined with a statutory claim, and the court proceeds to decide the statutory claim? never reaches a constitutional claim.
That's right.
And the plaintiff wins on the statutory claim. Is it your position that no fees are allowable?
That's right, Your Honor. No fees are allowed because, in fact, we say that...
Is that the practice in the courts now?
Are
the holdings...
I would say that there are several holdings otherwise.
Even if they decide only the statutory claim, there's fees available because of the joinder of a constitutional claim?
Yeah, as long as the claim has a common nucleus of operative fact.
I see.
Now, precisely what
that... I suppose if those cases are right, then this case is right, too.
Oh, that's right, Your Honor. Okay. That would be the case.
And doesn't the legislative history support that?
I think, Your Honor, that the legislative history does not support the claim in this case. It may have supported it in Huddle versus Finney. That was a case where a constitutional violation was found. In this case, there was no constitutional violation found, and the legislative history does not address specifically the 11th Amendment state's immunity, but the district court concluded that on the basis of the House report, which provided that when the claims are combined, an award may be made. But it is our claim that the Congress did not intend or purport to abrogate the threshold, the requirement of Fitzpatrick, which is that the threshold fact of congressional authorization to abrogate a state's immunity can only be present when there is authorization of Congress specifically authorizing a suit against the state in legislation enacted pursuant to Section 5 to enforce a substantive guarantee of the 14th Amendment. And that was absent here. Now, if Congress meant, nevertheless, to make a pronouncement that we declare we are enforcing substantive guarantee of the 14th Amendment when we say any claim brought under Section 1983, I don't think the history justifies that, because I think you must read when it says any claim brought. It's implicit that it means any claim brought to enforce civil rights or a substantive guarantee of the 14th Amendment.
Isn't 1983 passed pursuant to 5 of the 14th Amendment?
Under the analysis of Chapman... I would say no, Your Honor, under the analysis of Chapman, because in a case of this kind, that is just, if you will, the admission ticket to the federal court, the 1983 action. But the underlying...
So I'm not talking about this case. My point was, wasn't 1983 itself passed pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment?
Our position is, Your Honor, that you cannot tell that in a case of this kind until you examine the underlying statute, which is the substantive basis of the 1983 claim. And so that's really the crux of the matter here. And Chapman says that 1983 confers no substantive benefits or rights on a claim of and by itself. You must look to the underlying claim. Now, of course, if the statutory claim was one provided...
So that in one case, 1983 is passed pursuant to Section 5, and in another case, it's not. Is that your answer?
No, Your Honor. I think 1983 is never passed. It's just an admission ticket to get to federal court. It's the underlying claim that determines whether or not it's a 14th Amendment claim that's being enforced.
Mr. Walsh, maybe you already covered it. The underlying claim here is the same kind Mr. Justice White described, both constitutional and statutory, wasn't it?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that when I refer to the underlying claim, we mean the statutory claim, and the 1983 claim is the constitutional claim.
Well, there was here an underlying constitution. There is an allegation of a violation of the Constitution here, wasn't there?
There's a recital of a constitutional claim, Your Honor. It's our position that...
And that's what supported federal jurisdiction, because the statutory claim is pendant to the Constitution.
Under Higgins versus Levine.
Yeah.
But under Chapman, when you analyze the Chapman decision, that this court has analyzed it, it really says there is no constitutional claim, because...
But wasn't that a case in which there was no constitutional claim?
Chapman was a jurisdictional question, yes, Your Honor. There was no constitutional claim.
And here there was both a constitutional and a statutory claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't it fit the description of the kind of case in which the statute allows attorney's fees. It is a proceeding brought under 1983 in view of the fact that one of the underlying claims is constitutional in character.
But see, Your Honor, Chapman tells us that 1983 confers no substantive rights.
Well, they don't argue that 1983 confers any substantive rights. As I understand, they say their substantive rights were protected, A, by the Constitution. That's not been, you know, the merits of that wasn't resolved, and B, by the statute. That's where their substantive rights come from. I don't think they rely on 1983 as granting them substantive rights.
Well, they may be relying on 1988, but the point is 1988
gives them the attorney's fees.
1988 provides that in any claim brought under 1983.
Right. And they say it was brought under 1983 because one of the underlying substantive rights was conferred by the Constitution.
But we say Congress didn't mean any claim when they said any claim. We say it's implicit that they meant any claim brought to enforce a civil rights or a substantive guarantee of the 14th Amendment. That's how it must be read. That in effect, they really did not bring a constitutional claim, even though they recited one. That's what we get out of Chapman.
But if it's not part of the case, there's no jurisdiction.
Well, unfortunately, that's the trouble of the liberal test of Higgins versus Levine. It has been determined that the very liberal substantiality test,
right,
the court will say if it's sufficient to get them into the federal court, then we'll consider the statutory claim. But that still does not confer, as I understand Chapman, any substantive constitutional right on the plaintiff's claim. You must look to the underlying statute.
I don't understand.
Now, the respondent has also cited the case of Katzenbach versus Morgan for the proposition, I think, if I understood him correctly, that once Congress has determined that it was acting pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which has been suggested. They said when we enacted 1983, we were acting pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, and that is not for this Court even to question Congress as to whether or not that was a proper exercise of their power under Section 5. Mr. Justice Harlan, in his dissenting opinion in Katzenbach, spoke about that problem, saying that if Congress was making that claim, they were claiming they had a right themselves, alone, without review by this Court, to define the substantive scope of the 14th Amendment. And as Mr. Justice Harlan pointed out, if that were the case, it would give Congress the right to alter decisions of this Court. In fact, we think that that's what happened here. In effect, the legislative history was used to alter a provision of Fitzpatrick versus Bitzer, because under this test of a common nucleus of operative fact, it isn't essential that Congress be acting pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. They may be or they may not be. And precisely what a common nucleus of operative fact between a statutory claim and a constitutional claim is unclear. If the statutory claim itself provided for enforcement of the 14th Amendment, there would be no problem and there would be no case here. Now, of course, the Senate report in the legislative history points out at page 6342 of the 1977 Congressional News that the Fees Act, is limited to causes arising under our civil rights laws. And, of course, the purpose of the Act was stated to cure the gaps brought about by the Ilyeska decision in the award of attorney's fees in civil rights cases. And so we say Congress only intended, when they enacted the Fees Act, to authorize fees for claims brought to enforce the 14th Amendment. And in this case, the plaintiffs were not trying to enforce a 14th Amendment substantive guarantee, although they did recite 1983 and framed their statutory claim in terms of constitutional due process and equal protection.
Well, what if the case has gone to trial and the judge addressed the statutory issue first, and found against you. I suppose the statutory claim was that the state law was inconsistent with federal?
Right, yes, sir.
That's called a statutory claim, yes, although it's a supremacy clause claim.
Supremacy clause claim, yes, sir.
But suppose the judge had said this is wholly consistent with the federal law, and then he had gotten to the constitutional claim and said, well, both the state and the federal law are unconstitutional as a denial of equal protection. Would there be attorney's fees?
If the court found that there was a violation, a constitutional violation of the 14th Amendment, then I think there's no question that it would be interpreted as enforcing the 14th Amendment.
What would be?
The plaintiff's action as an action brought to enforce the 14th Amendment. Yes.
Well, what if your settlement agreement had expressly recited that that you were settling both the constitutional and the statutory claim?
Well, under my analysis, Your Honor, I think that, of course,
the
parties...
Well, the suit would still have been brought for exactly the same purpose.
That's right, Your Honor. I think the trouble is that these actions are brought in terms of the constitutional question because there's no jurisdiction under 1331 because of the $10,000 limitation.
Yes.
At any rate, the Senate report says that the Fees Act was intended just to be limited to civil rights cases. This is not a civil rights case, and so we think Congress in the legislative history had no such intention of abrogating the state's 11th Amendment immunity. Now, the second issue in the case is, as the Second Circuit held, that the 11th Amendment is not a bar to an award of attorney's fees in this case in any event, because it comes within the permissible ancillary effect doctrine of Edelman versus Jordan, which held that a state treasury, a state may be required to expend funds from its treasury when it's enforcing an order limited to prospective injunctive relief, and in such a case, that is just an ancillary effect not barred by the 11th Amendment. The circuits are divided on this question, as the Court of Appeals indicated in its opinion. It seems to me, and I think that the respondent's brief concedes that this is an extension of the careful definition of what an ancillary effect was in Edelman. And it is an expansion of that doctrine from one which is the necessary consequence of compliance with an order for prospective injunctive relief to a fee awarded in a case brought to obtain an order for prospective injunctive relief. And so consequently, we feel that it is not in accord with Edelman versus Jordan, the ancillary effect, and that it should, consequently, for both those reasons, the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed. And there was a cross appeal which was remanded to the district court, the respondent's cross appeal, and that should be, if the case is dismissed, that should be vacated. I would like, Your Honor, to save any time I have remaining for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Walsh. Ms. Pilger.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Joan Pilver, and I represent the respondent for Virginia Gagné in this matter. I would like to begin by offering just a further response to the question posed by Mr. Justice Rehnquist with regard to why the matter of the attorney's fees was not taken up in the consent decree itself. And there are really two reasons. One, because we felt it would create a potential conflict of interest situation, which we think can arise in any situation where attorney's fees are attempted to be resolved within the consent decree. The fact that there was a legal dispute between the parties meant that there would have been no way the matter could have been resolved within the consent decree. And in fact, the entire consent decree would have not have been able to have been entered if, in fact, we had had insisted on the matter of attorney's fees being in the consent decree itself.
Well, I've been away from the private practice for 10 years, and perhaps things have changed a good deal since then, but For instance, in other federal statutes like Title VII, the Freedom of Information Act, Equal Credit Opportunity Act, also provide for the award of attorney's fees. And in the 60s, at any rate, it was the practice, if you were settling a case and the statute authorized an award of under which the plaintiff was suing, authorized an award of attorney's fees to the prevailing party, you settled that at the same time. I mean, that was one of the issues in dispute, and if you were going to settle a case, you settled whether or not the person was going to get attorney's fees.
I think that's a good point, Your Honor. However, I would suggest in this particular case, the law in this area was very unclear. The defendant took the position that as a matter of right, we were not entitled to attorney's fees. This was prior to the decision of this court in Hutto versus Finney. So it was really a legal decision that had to be made by the court. Additionally, I think several courts have expressed the opinion, in particular a recent decision by the court in the Prandini versus National Tea Company, of the various kinds of potential conflicts of interest that can arise when the matter of attorney's fees is settled within the consent decree itself. The fact that some of the substantive provisions in the consent decree can be bargained away in exchange for the attorney's fees.
Well, that's certainly true in any litigation that I'm familiar with, is that one of the things on the table, so to speak, is whether the plaintiff recovers not only $150,000 for the loss of an arm, but $25,000 attorney's fees. And that
costs.
And you simply negotiate those out. And you may have to give up some substantive right or give up some part of your substantive recovery in order to get your attorney's fees.
I think that's very possible in those cases where the plaintiff will otherwise have to pay his counsel's attorney's fees. In many of the cases brought under the Civil Rights Attorney's Fees Awards Act, the plaintiff will have no fees with which to pay his counsel, and the only fee that will be paid will come from the defendant. So that where the only interest that the plaintiff has is in the substantive settlement, and the attorney, on the other hand's interest will be in recovering. And in that situation...
But that's true in a typical contingent fee action, too, isn't it, where you mm-hmm. have a plaintiff who has little or no money and is dependent upon the recovery to pay his own attorney.
That's quite true, Your Honor.
Do you think there is any analogy, Ms. Pilver, in this situation and the one where parties will agree or stipulate consent to liability but submit for, on a litigated basis, the issue of the amount of damages?
I think there is a similarity, and I think that kind of approach is very useful to settle the merits of the case first and then allow those other matters to be handled either in a separate negotiation or, if they cannot settle it, then to allow it to be decided by the court. I think in these kind of cases, I think it's really something that should be encouraged because of the potential problems that can arise. Two terms ago, this court in Hutto versus Finney held that Congress has plenary power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to set aside a state's immunity from retroactive relief and permit an award of attorney's fees to be entered against state officials acting in their official capacities under the Civil Rights Attorney's Fees Awards Act of 1976. The case before you today differs from Hutto in only two respects, neither of which do we believe are material or sufficiently different to justify a result different from that in Hutto. While the case in Hutto was settled on the merits, this case was resolved by consent decree. And while in Hutto,
Did you mean it was settled on the merits or litigated on the merits?
It was, I'm sorry, litigated on the merits, Your Honor. This case was settled. While the claims in Hutto were based solely on the Constitution, in this case, the plaintiff coupled her constitutional claims with a claim under the Social Security Act. The plaintiff maintains that neither of these differences is sufficiently substantial to justify any kind of result that would be different from that in Hutto.
What was the first difference?
The first difference is the fact that in Hutto the case was tried on the merits.
And here it was.
And
settled.
In this case it was settled. The civil rights attorney.
Isn't there still another difference? In Hutto, the constitutional claim was an Eighth Amendment claim. And here the constitutional claim is a 14th Amendment claim. And in Hutto, Mr. Justice Rehnquist thought that might be significant, so that maybe you have a response to his position in this case.
Well, if I understood Mr. Justice Rehnquist's position in Hutto, it was that because the Eighth Amendment has been incorporated into the 14th Amendment, it is not as clear that in acting pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment,
But you don't have that obstacle.
No, we don't.
Suggesting. So that's, in one sense, your case is stronger than Hutto.
Yes, that's quite correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That is true. This is the Civil Rights Attorneys Fees Awards Act itself sets only two criteria that must be met before an award of fees can be made under the discretion of the judge. One, it must be brought under one of the enumerated statutes, and two, the prevailing party, the person who is seeking the fees must be the prevailing party. We believe that this case meets both criteria. It is clear that this case was brought under one of the enumerated statutes, namely 42 U.S.C. 1983. The plaintiff alleged constitutional claims, which both courts below found to be substantial under the relevant Higgins versus Levine test, the test which was also suggested by Congress to be used in these kinds of instances. The defendant, however, suggests that this case is not properly brought under 42 U.S.C. 1983 because the plaintiff coupled her constitutional claims with statutory claims. But this court has yet to hold that a statutory claim may not be properly brought under 42 U.S.C. 1983. And even if this court were to so hold in a future case, it would not be appropriate for decision here because in this case, a claim was properly brought under the Constitution, thus bringing it within 42 U.S.C. 1983. Additionally, it is very clear from the legislative history that Congress had intended fee awards to be made in cases joining constitutional and statutory claims. In the debates and reports by Congress, it indicated that they wished to continue the practices and judicial standards that had been established prior to the passage of the Fees Awards Act, including the coupling of constitutional and statutory claims. Congress was well aware of the impact that a decision denying fees in cases joining constitutional and statutory claims would have. The fact that plaintiffs would be discouraged from bringing cases if their rights to fees could so easily be defeated. The fact that the inability to award fees in cases joining constitutional and statutory claims might compel judges to unnecessarily decide constitutional questions, thus defeating a very important policy of this court. Alternatively, the prospect arises that a plaintiff who believes he has a meritorious statutory claim might refrain from raising it in the fear that if he were to prevail on the statutory claim, he would then be denied fees. This possibility alone would have a very negative impact on the judicial system. The plaintiff thus maintains that Congress's purpose in passing the Fees Act to encourage the filing of meritorious litigation and the under the 14th Amendment and the important goals of judicial economy, judicial efficiency, and the appropriate adjudication of constitutional questions would all be disturbed if this court were not to allow fees in cases joining constitutional and statutory claims. Thus, the plaintiff believes she meets the first criteria set out in the Civil Rights Attorneys Fees Awards Act. Additionally, she believes she meets the second criteria, namely that she is the prevailing party. Both courts below believe that the plaintiff had achieved almost all that she had sought in her complaint and that what she had achieved was significant. The Court of Appeals, in reviewing the case below, concluded that the defendant changed his policies reluctantly and only under the pressure of the suit. It is vitally important that plaintiffs who settle be treated as prevailing parties for the purposes of the Act. A large percentage of cases that are filed or settled and it is an option often thought of and certainly always considered by parties. And it would be unfair to deny that option to parties solely for them to be able to insure themselves a fee award. Clearly, not allowing fees and settled allowing fees in cases resolved by consent decree would discourage the voluntary settlement of disputes. For as the Court of Appeals suggested, it would otherwise require parties to litigate solely to ensure a fee award.
Ms. Pelver, do you make anything at all of the first paragraph in the consent decree saying nothing in this consent decree is intended to constitute an admission of fault by either party to this action?
No, I don't, Your Honor. That was something that was agreed to solely for the parties to negotiate the settlement. And I would point out, neither did the plaintiff agree that she was withdrawing any of the allegations contained in her complaint.
Well, the defendant hadn't accused her of any fault.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear you.
The defendant hadn't accused her of any fault, had
it? No, but the plaintiff did make allegations in the complaint, which, you know, we certainly maintain to this day that if the matter had gone to trial, that we would have prevailed.
Regarded this as just kind of boilerplate that you stuck in at the request of the defendants?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, isn't it really boilerplate? Have you ever seen a stipulation of this kind of consent to a consent decree that doesn't have it in?
That's right, I haven't, Your Honor.
We'll settle it, but we'll admit nothing.
That's right, Your Honor. I think that's always done in almost every case I've ever dealt with. Further, as I mentioned before, we feel that not allowing fees except in the context of a consent decree could create a potential for conflicts of interest, which, you know, I've mentioned, and which I think is something that should be considered by this Court. Again, the legislative history is clear and indicates that Congress intended fees to be awarded in cases resolved by consent judgment. Neither would permitting an award of fees in cases resolved by consent further the filing of nuisance litigation, which is certainly of concern to the Court, because as here, the Court must first find that there is at least a substantial constitutional claim warranting jurisdiction. They must find that there were benefits brought about as a result of the settlement, and that the benefits that resulted came because of the plaintiff's conduct and would not otherwise have occurred, regardless of the plaintiff's actions. All these are matters that the defendant remains free to contest in any hearing on attorney's fees. To require any greater showing would only discourage settlement of disputes, and discourage the benefits achieved by settlement, the saving of court time and effort, the saving of time, expense, and effort by the litigants, the parties, and the attorneys. To require a greater showing of the likelihood of success on the merits would also require the unnecessary decision of constitutional questions. Thus, in sum, the plaintiff believes she meets the two primary criteria set out in the Fees Act for allowing an award of fees to be made in this case. Because, however, the defendant claims that he is subject to an immunity under the 11th Amendment, he asserts that even if we did prevail, even if we are entitled to fees under these two criteria, we are nevertheless barred from an award. The plaintiff believes, however, as mentioned earlier, that Hutto versus Finney is the appropriate precedent for deciding this question. The validity of this Court's ruling that in passing the Fees Act, Congress was exercising its power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment has no less validity in a case resolved by consent than in any other. The legislative history relied upon by this Court in Hutto to come to the conclusion that states were intended to be covered by the Act is in this case only buttressed further by the additional legislative history indicating that fees were also intended to be awarded in cases resolved by consent. Certainly, the comparison of fees to costs in Hutto and the quotation from Fairmount Creamery Company versus Minnesota that a court's interest in expeditious and orderly proceedings justifies it in treating a state as any other litigant has no less validity in a case resolved by consent. Additionally, although not explicitly stated, the plaintiff believes that the court in Hutto implied strongly that attorney's fees, being so closely akin to costs, that like costs, they should not be subject to a state's 11th Amendment immunity. We believe that a holding by this court to that effect here would follow logically from this court's holding in Hutto, and would not strain the distinction drawn by the court in Edelman versus Jordan between prospective relief and the costs ancillary thereto, and retroactive relief, which is akin to damages and barred by the 11th Amendment. But even if this court were to hold that attorney's fees are generally subject to the 11th Amendment, we believe that Congress was acting appropriately under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment in passing legislation allowing fees to be awarded in cases resolved by consent judgment. Through extensive hearings, Congress was well aware that many parties could not afford the legal fees involved in bringing actions under laws passed pursuant to the 14th Amendment. And Congress reasonably concluded that shifting the attorney's fee to the losing party was a reasonable way of encouraging such litigation. Likewise, Congress was acting reasonably in concluding that an award of fees in consent judgment cases also furthered that policy. Congress has acted remedially in giving another tool of use to the judiciary to use for the process of encouraging the filing of litigation under the 14th Amendment. And it's a tool as useful in consent judgment cases as in any other. Further, the Act leaves the ultimate decision as to whether to award fees to the discretion of the judge, leaving it to him to decide, as here, whether there was a substantial constitutional claim justifying a finding of jurisdiction, whether the benefits achieved were valuable, and whether they came as a result of the suit having been brought. Thus, Congress, even in settled cases, has left the determination and the interpretation of the substantive guarantees of the 14th Amendment to the judiciary, where it rightfully belongs. Thus, the plaintiff below and the respondent here believes that the award of fees made by the district court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals was proper under the Civil Rights Attorneys Fees Act and follows logically from and is consistent with this court's holding in Hutto versus Finney. Thank you very much.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Mr. Walsh?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, just a couple of points. In Hutto versus Finney, this court stated that attorney's fees may be awarded as part of the costs, and the 11th Amendment would not seem to be a bar to that. I would respectfully submit that I don't think that the legislative history warranted that conclusion. At least, even if it did, in this case, if it is true that the plaintiffs were not seeking to enforce a 14th Amendment guarantee, then there is no congressional authorization, even if the Congress has the power to give such authorization, under the Fees Awards Act. This court distinguished it, Hutto.
Mr. Walsh, can I interrupt you on the question whether the legislative history supports the notion that fees might be awarded as part of the cost? I think the statute itself, which you quote on pages 3 and 4 of your brief, ends up by saying that a reasonable attorney's fee as part of the costs. Doesn't that kind of imply that it's supposed to be part of the cost?
Yes, Your Honor, but it isn't. It is part of the cost where the 11th Amendment is not an issue. The Fees Act, the purpose of the Act and the proponents of the Act all indicated that they were not enacting any startling new legislation. It was just to fill the gaps created by Alyeska decision. Now, actually, the costs have not been changed since, I think, the Judiciary Act of 1853, and so that if that was their intention, I think that would have been more than just no startling new remedy and legislation and just to fill in the gaps. But in a case where civil rights are not being enforced, there is no authorization, I think, in the legislative history specifically to abrogate that amendment in a non-civil rights case. Congress doesn't claim such power, or has not. It may have such power, but it doesn't claim it in this act. I want to make one other point that Hutto itself distinguished distinguished Fitzpatrick from Edelman, and it said Fitzpatrick begins where Edelman ends. But this case is very similar to Edelman. There was a constitutional claim in Edelson of equal protection, and there was a statutory Social Security claim. So I think it'd be fair to say that Edelman controls this case, and that this case ends where Edelman ended. And Fitzpatrick began where there was the threshold question of congressional authorization, which isn't present here. I would just like to make one other remark to Mr. Justice Marshall's earlier question. My point was that Chapman said there is no jurisdiction under 1328 U.S. Code 1343 3 or 4 to hear a case in which there is just a statutory claim. And so it may well be that in this case we have what Mr. Justice Marshall pointed out in his dissenting decision in Employees, a constitutional claim which the federal district court does not have jurisdiction over because Congress has not given fully implemented its Article III power to award that jurisdiction. With respect to Mr. Justice Blackmun's remarks about the being a customary provision, a boilerplate, if you will, we would just point out that there was only one single plaintiff throughout the entire more than 2 years of litigation in this case, and that the plaintiff in the consent decree did not obtain the injunctive relief which she sought, and she did not obtain the equivalent of the injunctive relief she sought because the state did not change its amended policy. It's still in effect. That's the one contained in the appendix at page 68-69. And so we think that Edelman versus Jordan should be controlling in this case because it is so similar to Edelman versus Jordan. And for that reason, we ask that the court reverse the decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Whirlpool Corporation.